Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. For generations, the Wrights of Southern Utah have raised cattle and world champion saddle bronc riders. Some call them the most successful rodeo family in history. Now Bill and Evelyn Wright, parents to 13 children and grandparents to many more, find themselves struggling to hang on to the majestic landscape where they've been running cattle for 150 years as the West is transformed by urbanization, battered by drought, and rearranged by public land disputes. Could rodeo, of all things, be the answer? Pulitzer Prize-winning writer John Branch chronicles 3 years in the life of the Wrights in The Last Cowboys, a pioneer family in the New West. We'll revisit our conversation from May of 2018 with John Branch following the news. Welcome to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. For generations, the Wrights of Southern Utah have raised cattle and world champion saddle bronc riders. Some call them the most successful rodeo family in history. Now Bill and Evelyn Wright, parents to 13 children and grandparents to many more, find themselves struggling to hang on to the majestic landscape where they've been running cattle for 150 years as the West is transformed by urbanization, battered by drought, and rearranged by public land disputes. Could rodeo, of all things, be the answer? Pulitzer Prize-winning writer John Branch chronicles 3 years in the life of the Wrights in The Last Cowboys, a pioneer family in the New West. John Branch is a reporter for the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing in 2013 for Snowfall, a story about a deadly avalanche in Washington State. He was a finalist for the prize in 2012 for his series of stories about Derek Bogard, a professional hockey player who overdosed on painkiller. In his first book, Boy on Ice, The Life and Death of Derek Bogard, won the Penn ESPN Prize for Literary Sports Writing. He was raised in Colorado and lives with his family near San Francisco. One note about this conversation, when I recorded this talk with John Branch, he was at the airport, so you'll hear us occasionally competing with PA announcements. Hopefully it's not too distracting. So here now is part one of my conversation from May of 2018 with John Branch. How did you discover this family?
Yeah, I discovered them through an old editor of mine. I used to be a columnist at the Fresno Bee, and when I moved on to the New York Times, I stayed in touch with my old editor there. He had retired to the Las Vegas area, and over breakfast one day in Las Vegas, he told me all about the Wrights. He followed rodeo a little bit, and just told me about this family of boys that were dominating saddle bronc standings at that time, and thought it might be an interesting story. And he knew a little bit about the Wrights and Bill Wright running some cattle up there outside of St. George, and thought this might be a nice tale for the New York Times. And so I ended up spending about a year off and on with the Wrights and wrote that story for the New York Times, and that was 3 years ago. And we decided to build it into a full-fledged book after that.
And so it's rodeo, it's ranching, it's family, it's heritage, it's a lot of things. Tell me how you came up with the title, The Last Cowboys.
Yeah, I mean, I really think that there's a sense that, you know, people who maybe aren't familiar with the West maybe believe that this whole world is kind of disappearing or has disappeared. They may not realize that there are 600 or 700 rodeos out there every year. They may not realize how many people are still involved in the ranching. But it is, and it does feel like something that's fading. And so it's not hard to imagine my kids, my grandkids, maybe my great-grandkids, not ever really having a lot of experience with it. You know, will cattle ranching continue to be a big part of the West? How will we treat our public lands? So it's really a nod to kind of a question. Are these the last cowboys? Are these the last vestiges of a West that really made our country?
So you go back and you pick up a little pioneer heritage of Bill Wright. He's the patriarch of the family. And it's coming down to what? His sons are the sixth generation and his grandsons are the seventh generation, your grandchildren, mm-hmm. the seventh generation. Tell me a little bit about how this the family got started in this land.
Yeah, you know, they were part of the Mormon migration. I think Bill's great-great-grandparents came in 1849 to the Salt Lake Valley, and then as part of the Cotton Mission, came down south in, I believe, 1862, and have been around that area ever since. Evelyn, his wife, her family, about the same time, came down to that area, and she, her family's from Tocqueville. And so Bill and Evelyn, you know, five or six generations later, then met as kids, as teenagers, in Hurricane, and began dating. But they have deep roots there. The family's been running cattle on Colob Terrace and Smith Mesa for most of the time since then, including after I believe Bill's grandparents, now I forget now, great-grandparents or grandparents, homesteaded in that area as well. So, yeah, they run deep, and cattle has been a big part of all those generations.
150 years, right, on this land the family has been there.
That's exactly right, yeah. Right all around Virgin. Smith Mesa, where this a lot of this book takes place, is just up outside of Virgin, right up against what is now the Zion border, the western border of Zion.
So what are the issues that they're facing? This is, I guess, would epitomize the issues that a lot of ranching families are facing.
Yeah, I mean, this is really a book not really meant to be nostalgic in any sort of way. It's more, set fully in the 21st century. And the rights, like so many others, are dealing with the issues that people out west are dealing with. And that is things like urbanization. You know, a lot of family farms have gone by the wayside for whatever reason, corporate interests have bottom up, or they just don't have generations of kids that are interested in doing it. Bill is certainly among those that he's dealing in a very real way with the federal land issues. You know, he's looked at land over by Bear's Ears, and that has scared him off, not knowing what's going to happen with the borders of Bear's Ears, for example. He's not far from Clive and Bundy. He has kind of a love-hate relationship, I think, with the federal government, sees both sides of their role in what he does. You know, most of the land that he uses to raise these cattle is federal land. He's also dealing with things like climate change and drought. The drought of the last few years has thrown the cycles of his herd off. So in very micro kinds of ways, he is dealing with all these issues that are, I think, pretty widespread around the West. You know, everything from water to federal land use. To urbanization, and now he's got some of that urbanization coming right to his front door, as St. George kind of explodes as a both a retirement community and as a recreational community. He's feeling the squeeze. You know, he thought he used to be out in the middle of nowhere, and now he's starting to feel the squeeze a little bit.
What does he think of Clive and Bundy and the standoff that happened a few years ago?
Yeah, you know, he says he knows Clive and Bundy a little bit and considers him a good cattleman and a good rancher. Certainly Bill does not have the disposition to get involved, I don't think, in any sort of, sort of public event like that, but he has opinions. So I think in some respects he probably agrees with Clive and thinks that Clive was picked on. That debate goes back more than 20 years over the desert tortoise. And, Bill wonders, what's next? Is it government going to come tell me that I have the desert tortoise on my land, or these black gnats, I think I write in the book, that are all over the property on hot summer days? He's like, are they going to make that a protected species, and then they're going to tell me I can't raise my cattle here? You know, it's another one of those things that frustrates him, I think, with the unpredictability of what the government might come along and do on the land that he believes he's a very good caretaker of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you talk to ranching families, they believe they have for generations taken care of the land, and now it's kind of a mixed reaction to, the federal bureaucrats as they see them in some cases. You learned about federal permits, I guess, writing this book. I learned from your book about the Taylor Grazing Act of 1934. I guess it was an attempt to head off overgrazing, but some ranchers see maybe over-bureaucratization of this issue.
Yeah, it's interesting, and I think it's been painted recently as a very kind of black and white issue. This, should the land be in federal hands or not? And I know they're in Utah. It's a big issue. A lot of people are pushing for local control of these lands. If you ask a rancher like Bill Wright, he'll say, well, it's complicated. Yeah, he has some big issues with the feds. Most of his land that he uses is BLM or Forest Service land. He has some big issues, but the solution, I don't think, to him is simply to turn it over to local control. Because right now, as frustrating as it is to have one jurisdiction in the hands of the federal government, to him, I think that's probably better than to have land divided up that he has to deal with between the federal government and maybe county government and maybe private land. he doesn't love his landlords always, but maybe it's easier to have one landlord than a bunch of landlords.
Now, was it his father? Where along the line do you know did they start grazing on public lands, having to do the permits?
I think about the generations here. Either his father or his grandfather back in the 30s have a permit. In fact, one of the permits they have is still one that they have continued to renew. That goes back now, whatever that would be, 70 years or so. So even from a public land standpoint, they have been using permits for a long time. The Wright family has about 1,200 acres there, which sounds like a lot, I think, to most folks. But, you know, because of the sparse vegetation there, you need a lot more land than that for a decent-sized cattle herd. And so they lease from the federal government and from a few private landowners down there, close to 20,000 acres. So the issue is for them is that as they would like to grow this herd, they are really kind of squeezed in there. They have this beautiful island, as pretty as any place, I think, in the world, right at the doorstep of Zion National Park, and they'd like to grow a herd there. But it's, you know, that land is now very expensive. It's very treasured. He has conservationists who are pushing him to protect it. He has developers pushing him to sell it. He would love to grow there, but he's kind of squeezed in by a lot of different elements now.
And these permits are pretty expensive, I take it.
Yeah, I mean, they run in the tens of thousands of dollars. Depends on what they are, and it's really a complicated maze. I had no idea just how complicated they are. You know, the ranchers don't think in terms of acres. You know, trying to get Bill to explain how many acres he's running, he doesn't think of it that way. He thinks of it in terms of animal units per month, which means he may get a permit that allows him to run on 4 months a year up to, I'm just making up numbers here, 100 head of cattle. And then outside those 4 months, he's got to find another permit somewhere else. Those permits are basically designed, you know, by the BLM, for example, to say this is what this land can handle. It can handle, in that example, 100 cattle over 4 months, but the other 8 months it has to be emptied. What, you know, you kind of worry about is that when this permit comes up for renewal every 10 years, that the federal government might say, you know what, you're being a little hard on the land there. Instead of 100 head of cattle, now you can only do 50. And as a rancher, you start thinking, well, this makes my life really difficult if I don't have control over that. But for most of these ranchers, it's still a cheaper and better option than it is to have all private land. You know, most of Utah and many states around the West are majority public land. And so they deal with it, but they don't always like the unpredictability of it. They're trying to build something long-term here, and that can be very difficult when you have a patchwork of these permits.
And Bill Wright does say that he, you know, if he could, maybe he'd sell the private land that he does have and try to get something, a larger spread, away from the public land there, right? Because his quote is, he says, this ground seems to be worth more as scenic land than agricultural land. They're, I guess, near Zion or in Zion?
Yeah, right near Zion. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of his dilemma, because even if he were to buy the land from fellow private landowners around there, that land is now so valuable that it really makes no sense to run cattle on it. So, you know, does he have enough money to buy that and just make this a really pretty ranch, overpaying for the ground there? Does he, you know, follow his head or his heart? I mean, that family's been there for 150 years, and the fact that they're kind of stuck in this catch-22. It's a beautiful spot of land. It's a beautiful area. But now maybe it's become too popular. And so now the question is, you follow your head and sell it off and go buy land cheaper somewhere else that may be better for growing a herd, or you follow your heart and somehow figure out a way to make this land down there work.
Does when you talk to Bill Wright, does he talk about conservation? Does he... Mm-hmm. You know, does the environmentalists come up, you know, the clashes or working with it? You know, what does he think about conservation?
Yeah, you know, he's done actually some conservation programs. You know, there are programs where they will basically pay you to either not farm or to farm certain parts of your property. And there's lots of little kind of federal grants and things you can do to try to make this all work. There are conservationists who raise enough money and have done so in that area to say, we would like to pay you, basically, we'll take the land, but you get to keep using it. What we're trying to do is keep it out of developers' hands. So So you basically sign a contract saying, I will not sell to developers, and the conservationists now have created some sort of buffer to keep those developers away. Bill's talked to a lot of those kind of folks. It's always a little bit of a concern, you know, what kind of restrictions will be placed on me, and will those rules change over the years? What happens when my kids take this over, or my grandkids take this over? Will the rules have changed? In terms of conservation also, he has, you know, that area has become a highly recreational area. There are mountain biking, there's tons of hikers. And in his mind, it's becoming more and more apparent to him that the priority there is more recreation than ranching. And that scares him a little bit. He worries that the BLM will say, you know what, this is not so much a great ranching place anymore. It's now better for recreational uses. And they could sort of chase him away that way. So there are just a lot of uncertainties. All those things are this kind of mix that he's always trying to deal with and trying to figure out what's the long-term solution here. What's it going to be like 10 years from now, 20 years from now, 50 years from now?
And in fact, apparently, on his private land, he's thinking of some other things. You know, let's do some other things besides ranching, or at least add that on.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's kind of, you know, the end of the book, he has a little bit of a revelation without giving away too much, but he has a little bit of a revelation that maybe he can tiptoe both sides of this equation. And that's where it stands now. I mean, this is one of those books that I kind of wonder if a year from now I'll have to add another chapter or two for the paperback version because things will have changed. There is no real end to this book because it's an ongoing saga in my mind. But as it stands now, yeah, he is trying to ride a little bit of the middle ground, trying to hang on to the land, and maybe trying to adopt, or at least welcome to some extent, that encroachment that is now coming toward him.
I wonder if I have you talk a little bit about, and I know from the book, Bill Wright and Evelyn, his wife, they do think about legacy, right? You think of past, you think of the generations before, mm-hmm. and then their family, their sons and daughters are going to be sixth generation and the next one seventh generation. You inevitably think legacy, right? And so preserving that legacy and are the kids going to take this over and the grandkids?
Yeah, I think that's they're both kind of stuck in sort of that sort of interesting transition period right now with the boys, because all the boys are still doing rodeo and that seems to be their focus. So Bill is trying to keep the ranch operation going. He'd like to grow it. So that the boys, in theory, if they're interested, can step in and do it. And the question is, are they interested? And it seems like every year that goes by, they step into it a little bit deeper. You know, Cody has bought a bunch of head of cattle. Jesse, for example, has bought some permits outside of Beaver, where they do the summer range. Even Cody's kids are taking some of their rodeo earnings now and investing them into the cattle operation, which, you know, they're now invested to some degree financially. And I think Bill sees that as a sign that, yeah, this is something to be handed over, you know, that they are interested. And, I would be very surprised if Cody and some of his kids and a couple of Cody's brothers aren't part of this operation, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, 20 years from now.
I think it's Bill who says behind every successful rancher, there's a wife who works in town, right? And this is something we know here in Utah and rural areas.
Right.
Evelyn works in Milford. Maybe first, before you go there, the hurricane where they were got too big. So they moved 2 or 3 hours north.
Yeah, they moved a little bit north from there. They, you know, they grew up in that hurricane area, and it just got a little bit too big for them. They wanted to move to a smaller town, and so they moved up to Milford, and, you know, a little bit off the beaten path. Milford probably hasn't changed a lot in 50 years and probably won't change in the next 20, although it has been sort of overhauled away from, like, a mining area to a lot of solar and wind power. But they moved up there, I think, for what they thought was a smaller town and better schools. But their land is still down outside of Hurricane, outside of St. George there. And so they make that, you know, hour-long trip all the time in between those two. So they're kind of living duplicate lives. Lots of times Bill is down there on Smith Mesa working the herd, and Evelyn's teaching school up there in Milford, as are a couple of their daughters teach up there as well.
Yeah. By the way, I guess at a certain point you were introduced to that that pronunciation of the word hurricane.
Yes. I've never really had anybody explain to me in a real way why it's pronounced hurricane instead of hurricane, the way it's spelled. But I've told people, if you drive through there on your way to Zion and you stop there, make sure you say hurricane, and they'll think that maybe you're a local. At least you're well educated.
That's right. And it's if you just remember, it needs to sound like Leverkan, which is nearby. So Hurricane Leverkan.
Leverkan, yes. Exactly.
You talk about, and I'm familiar with this, growing up in rural Utah. You describe the way Bill and his family talks. It's not a Texas drawl. It's not a Southern drawl. You describe it as a rural drawl.
Yeah, and I don't know how else to describe it, really. I was just on the phone with Cody, and he definitely has that. I used to live in Fresno, and Fresno had a lot of Oklahomans. A lot of the Okies came and settled in the Central Valley. And so there are people in California that have this kind of Oklahoma accent that still exists these many generations later. And I think, it's a rural thing. I'm in New York, and, you listen to people talk in New York, and not everybody talks that way, but there are some that do. I think it just sort of is passed down through the generation somehow and manages to stick.
Tell me a little bit about the character of the family, this way of life, family culture. It would be similar to many other, ranching families, I suppose.
Yeah, I think what's interesting interesting aspect of this book is that this family in so many ways is just a typical family, right? They're just a family trying to stick to traditions. They see family first in just about every decision that they make. They're holding on to ways that they've been holding on to for many, many years. They're trying to build a future in the 21st century through ranching and rodeo. Not a lot of people, I think a dwindling number of people, would see that as your ticket to a healthy future. But they're also extraordinary in a couple of ways. One is that they have all these world champion saddle bronc riders, which then kind of allows them to take some of that money. And you don't get really rich in rodeo, and the next rodeo could be your last because there are a lot of injuries in rodeo. But they do very well. So several of the brothers do pretty well. So they have this kind of seed money if they want to use it for ranching, which kind of gives them a leg up over maybe some other families. And they really want to do it all together. I thought maybe when I got into this, I would find that the next generation would be like, no, I don't want to do this. I want to move to Salt Lake and work in an office and go to college and become a finance major or something. They all seem to really want to continue the tradition of working out on the land as a rancher or some sort of in rodeo. And I have not come across any of the rights of those 13 that have really stepped away and sort of become like a black sheep from what they've been doing for a lot of generations now.
You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams. We're revisiting my conversation from 2018 with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer John Branch. The book is The Last Cowboys, A Pioneer Family in the New West. A note that this program was a part of the Democracy and the Informed Citizen Initiative administered by the Federation of State Humanities Councils in partnership with the Pulitzer Prizes Board for a collaboration between UPR, Utah Humanities, the Salt Lake Tribune, and the Salt Lake City Library. That initiative seeks to deepen the public's knowledge and appreciation of vital connections between democracy, the humanities, journalism, and informed citizenry. The Democracy and Informed Citizen Initiative is supported by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. We'll have more of my conversation with John Branch following the news, following this break. You're listening to Access Utah. I'm Tom Williams, and we're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer John Branch, who chronicled 3 years in the life of a Southern Utah family, the Wrights, in his book, The Last Cowboys, A Pioneer Family in the New West. John Branch is a reporter for the New York Times. He won the Pulitzer Prize for feature writing in 2013 for Snowfall, a story about a deadly avalanche in Washington State. A previous book is called Boy on Ice, The Life and Death of Derek Bogart. Here is the second and last part of my conversation from May of 2018 with John Branch. Three world champions among those sons. In fact, Milford, you drive in and they acknowledge that this is home of the Wright family, home of world champions, right?
That's exactly right. You drive in and there is a kind of a signs on the three entrances to Milford, the three different highways that kind of come in and intersect there are signs that used to say, when I first started reporting this is the home of Cody Wright, two-time world champion. And then Jesse won, and then Spencer has since won. And they've had to update their signs a few times. Yeah. And even the little rodeo ring that is near the ballpark there in the center of town. They've named after Cody Wright. So there's a sign there as well. So certainly they are the most famous residents in Milford, and there are a lot of Wrights there. And if you're finding yourself wandering through Milford for whatever reason, if you're on that road, you'll certainly know, it's hard to miss, that Cody Wright and his brothers are the world champion saddle bronc riders there in town.
So Bill and Evelyn, 13 kids.
Yeah, they had 13 kids. You know, for people like me, I'm 10 years younger than Evelyn. I have two kids that are still growing up. She has 13 kids. I think she's close to 40 grandkids now, and I believe it's either 7 or 8 great-grandkids. Hmm. She's 60.
Yeah.
They started young.
Right.
13 kids over the course of, I don't know how many years, maybe 24 years or so. But 7 of those 13 are boys, and every one of those 7, led by Cody, who's the oldest of the boys, went into rodeo.
Mm-hmm.
And they've all then sort of fallen in line into saddle bronc.
Yeah.
And now Cody's boys, you know, Cody's only a little over 40, but he's got 3 boys now that are all professional rodeo cowboys as well. They're ages, you know, roughly 18, 20, 22. And in fact, one of his boys has now won a world championship. You know, I tell people this is like the Manning family is of football with all those quarterbacks. If only the Manning family had about 5 or 6 more NFL quarterbacks.
That's right. Plenty more where that came from, right? Let's talk
exactly.
a bit about the rodeo. This is extraordinary. Bill did what? He did bull riding and he did some saddle bronc and he migrated toward saddle bronc. You describe, I think this is your description, it's like being in an 8-second car wreck. That's your description of bull riding.
Of bull riding, yeah. To the Wrights, you know, all the boys have started out as kind of all-around cowboys. You know, they're pretty good ropers and that kind of thing, too. They do a lot of high school rodeos and then college rodeos to some extent. And then they all, every single one of them has then sort of merged and started to really focus on saddle bronc. And I think the reason is Bill believes it's the most beautiful of those rough stock events. He thinks it's the most real because it's actually, you know, its roots are from trying to break horses. It's not like bull riding, which is probably just some drunken stunt some night, but somebody said, I dare you to get on that bull. He thinks there's a real purpose in saddle bronc, or at least it has a heritage with a real purpose. And he also recognizes, and I think now the rest of the boys do, that you can be a saddle bronc rider for a lot of years. You don't see a lot of old bull riders. As much prestige and maybe money you might be able to make in bull riding these days, but you don't get old very well in bull riding. And so saddle bronc, as much as these guys are getting hurt, and the book is filled with a litany of all their injuries, and I think you still will understand that saddle bronc, if you're going to choose a crazy sport, saddle bronc is probably the least crazy of those.
And, I mean, people who are around rodeo know that injuries are a part of it, maybe fewer... A few fewer in saddle bronc. I had a friend one time was into bull riding. I did it professionally for a while, and you just waited for whatever the injury was that season. You know, you just knew there was going to come one. Tell us the rules. Tell us a little bit more about saddle bronc riding.
Yeah, so saddle bronc riding, I mean, it's just like the other ones where you basically need to hang on for 8 seconds. What's interesting about saddle bronc is that you're being judged on how pretty it looks, really. The judges on the rodeo floor there, they're judging both your ride, that's half the score, and they're judging how well the horse is doing, is bucking. That's half the score. And so you need to have a good horse that's bucking hard and bucking, for the most part, straight up and down. It's not like bull riding where the bulls will spin in circles and, you know, it's like trying to stay on a kaleidoscope. Saddle broncs are, you know, the best ones will just go up and down really, really high. They're trying to get you off. And the best cowboys to get a big score is to basically look like trying to make it look very easy. And when the horse's front hooves hit the ground, your front feet or your feet need to be up as high on the neck, up toward the mane as possible. And when the horse then kind of recoils and jumps off its back legs, you pump your feet back. And in theory, you're like a dance partner. So sometimes the best saddle bronc rides look kind of simple. It's usually not the crowd-pleasing rides that get the best scores. It's the ones that look like this man and this horse are in tandem together.
Well, here's a quote from you. Clinging for dear life excites the crowd, but it dulls the judges. That's it.
Yep.
You know, that's the kind of the dilemma there. I wonder, I don't know, you maybe never talked to the Wrights about this. I don't know if you have an opinion on this. I have wondered within myself when I've seen bull riders now with helmets, and I've thought that is very prudent. That's great for them, but it kind of dulls the excitement for me. And so what does that say about me, you know?
Right. And it's interesting because I think in the professional bull riders now, the tour that goes around the country, sort of separate from the rodeo circuit, I believe they are required to wear helmets. I did a story for the New York Times several years ago about that group. And at that time, they did not. But it's also, it's, you know, kind of like what we've seen in football. Then we saw in hockey. Hockey had helmets, and then they kind of grandfathered it in. So you do see in the rodeos, you'll see some bull riders with helmets, but not all of them. And I don't think I've seen a saddle bronc rider with a helmet. They're wearing cowboy hats. And so, yeah, concussions are a name of the game. Mm-hmm. I've written a lot over the years about concussions in sports. There's not been a lot of research, I don't think, done on rodeo cowboys and what kind of brain diseases they may get from a bunch of hits to the head. But certainly that is one of the fears, that they fall a lot, get kicked a lot in the head. And, you know, you just hope it's nothing tragic or life-altering.
There's a scene, this is in your New York Times article, you know, the first came out first, now you have the book, where Cody, on his dismount, I don't know if you call it that, but he's getting off the horse. There's usually a rider that comes up, could take you off, or I guess you jump off. Mm-hmm. He severely dislocated his shoulder, but then he gets back on, I guess, a little while later. You got to make the ride to make the money, right? And
exactly right.
Really taped up his and he does a beautiful ride, except he forgets to do one move that's required and he's disqualified, I guess, and it's because he's worried about his shoulder.
Yeah, this is kind of a sticking point in rodeo, and the Wrights have been on both sides of this, and that's called the markout rule. And the markout rule says, for most rodeo, they have the markout rule, and that means when that horse first comes out of the chute and its first jump and it lands on its front feet, your feet have to be up above the shoulders of the horse. If for some reason the horse comes out and on the first jump its front feet hit the ground, you have your feet back, which is kind of the more natural thing to do because you want to clench onto the side of the horse, then a flag is thrown, and it's literally like a penalty flag in football. And so you can have the greatest ride in the world, and we've seen some that are, you know, 90-point rides out of 100, which are extraordinary, and it actually counts for zero because a judge has deemed that your feet weren't in the right place on the first jump. And the Wrights have lost world championships over that, and others have lost world championships over that. You know, rodeo sticks to its traditions, too. There's no replay for the most part, which might prove otherwise, the way other sports have gone to replay. And anymore, and especially when you get to the National Finals Rodeo in Las Vegas in December, you could be talking about tens or even hundreds of thousands of dollar differences over a pretty subjective call. So, yeah, it's an interesting aspect of rodeo.
Tell me a little bit about the lifestyle. I learned a lot reading the book. It's days and days, hours and hours on the road, hundreds and thousands of miles. You get to the rodeo, and you might be bucked off, $0, right? Or you might win the purse.
Yeah, their life is extraordinary. It's one of the things that I learned very quickly that I thought was most surprising, in that when I talk to people about this, they are like, really, that's how that works? Yeah, there are no guarantees in rodeo. So they will drive, and I'll give you an example. They'll drive somewhere like this coming up weekend and get to a rodeo to compete on Friday night. And they may get bucked off, or they may miss their mark and get a zero score. They may actually ride well but be out of the money, and they get $0. There's no guarantee just for showing up. And then they will leave that rodeo, usually before the rodeo actually ends. There's a few more events after Saddle Bronc. And they'll get back in their truck to beat the crowd out of the fairgrounds or wherever it's being held. And they may drive overnight to be at a rodeo the next day, the next afternoon. And they may time it to then go to a rodeo maybe a few hours away that evening. And then maybe another Sunday rodeo the following day. They will sometimes do four or five rodeos in one weekend. They will drive hundreds of miles between rodeos, often overnight. These guys are all putting 100,000 miles on their trucks every year. And they camp in the back. They have campers usually on the back. And so usually you have four guys in a truck. You're splitting expenses. You have two guys up front hanging out and driving, and you usually have two guys in the back sleeping. It's funny now, whenever I drive around the West, my eye is very keen about, there goes a rodeo cowboy zipping by. You can just sort of see their trucks and kind of recognize what they look like now. It's an extraordinary nomadic lifestyle that they live. And, you know, you and I, who maybe go to the rodeo on a Friday night and think it's all fun, these guys are pulling in a half an hour before it starts, and they're out the door before the rodeo even ends, moving on to the next rodeo.
And the estimate, I think this was Cody estimated, you got to pull in, what, $65,000, $70,000 just to break even on your expenses.
Yeah. Yeah, and most of these rodeos, I mean, they know how the system works. So they know which rodeos pay out the best and that sort of thing. But most of these rodeos that we're talking about are maybe paying at least $1,000 for the winner. I mean, there are some that pay far less than that. But the rights are going to rodeos that will pay anywhere from $1,000 to maybe $3,000 for the winner. And you'd like to go to enough rodeos to get into the top 15 of the standings by the end of the year. That's a huge thing for them. And the standings are determined by how much money you've made. And so if you get into the top 15, which is usually about $60,000 or so, it has been the last couple of years, then you get to go to the National Finals Rodeo. And that is 10 nights in Las Vegas, sell out a crowd of 19,000 people every night. And the stakes there are $26,000 or $27,000 a round or 10 rounds. So you can multiply your money. You can get into the National Finals by going to 100 rodeos over the course of the year, and then over 10 nights, you might triple or quadruple your money if you have a really good run.
And so three world champions in the family now, over two generations, right? On the cover of the book, by the way, it's a couple of grandkids, right?
Yeah, actually now there's four, because three of the brothers have won, and now one of Cody's kids have. So there's actually four Wrights have won a total of five world championships over, like, I think the last 11 years or so. The cover of the book is a picture of Ryder Wright and Stetson Wright, who are two of Cody's boys. And that was taken a few years ago by Josh Hayner, a New York Times photographer. And those boys are now both professional cowboys, and Ryder won the world championship last year.
Mm. So some of the money is being plowed back into the ranch. Is that the way to support the ranch? They want to make sure it continues. Do they want to go back and work it?
Yeah, that's kind of the crux here. And you know, they don't do this solid accounting. It's not like, you know, they come back from a rodeo weekend and Cody or Bill or anybody else saying, okay, let's divvy this up and give X amount to the ranch or anything. If they are interested, then they will say, you know what, hey, Dad, I wouldn't mind giving some of this money, and if this can buy 20 head of cattle, let's go buy some cattle. Or if this will help buy that permit we need to expand a little bit, let's do that. And so nobody's asking them to do it. I mean, Bill is even like, you know, if they want to come do it, they know what needs to be done. So now Cody has bought in, and a couple of the other boys have bought in, and now the next generation is starting to buy in. But there's no, like, real arithmetic, no real expectation going on. It's very organic, and you know, that's one of the things that I find extraordinary about this family, is that they just deal with things as they come. You know, I think it's difficult for them to plan the future too far for all these different reasons that we've been talking about. But they are extraordinary at just dealing with things as they come. And that includes, you know, the next rodeo, you might win $100,000 like Cody did in Calgary a few years ago. Now, what are you going to do with that money? Do you want to put that into a new house? Do you want to put it into a car? Do you want to put it into a savings account? Or do you want to put it into the family ranch? It's totally up to you.
Now, as we've been talking, in the back of my mind, I'm thinking some of our listeners right now are staunch animal rights advocates.
Yep.
I wonder if any of that, you know, and some of who criticize rodeoing and criticize some aspects of ranching, I don't know if that seeps through mm-hmm. to the Wright family. Do they respond to that? Does it not come through? Do they not hear that criticism?
I don't think it. I mean, they're certainly aware of it. I mean, I've been to some rodeos where you might see a couple of protesters. You don't see it a lot. Rodeo, I think, to its credit, has changed a lot of its rules in terms of what, how to provoke animals and how to treat animals. I'm sure there are certainly critics that remain. I think it's interesting to sort of point at rodeo as being, you know, in some way inhumane. Certainly, you look at, like, the Bronx these guys are riding, for most part, these top Bronx may compete for 10 or 12 years, and they are usually going to about one rodeo every 3 weeks, and the rest of the time they are, I think, taken care of very well and out to pasture. I don't think they're overworked. You know, is that the best lifestyle for them? I don't know. I don't know what else would happen to them otherwise. You know, we're also talking about a sport that is part of the tradition of things like ranching. And so certainly there are plenty of vegans out there that may take exception with how ranchers and the millions of cattle that are killed every year to feed the people of the world. So to pick on, you know, rodeo as a sport, I think it's just, you know, emblematic of a lifestyle. I think they've made some changes. And I've been around the chutes quite a bit, and I have not seen anything that has made me kind of go, ooh, that's not good. You know, that has made me wince. I think those animals, you know, they're respected. You know, this is a lifestyle that these people respect. And these horses and bulls, for example, cost a lot of money, and they have long, long tenures. So it behooves people to take good care of them.
No, we need to let you get going here. Just one last question. What do you take away now, having spent this time with the extended Wright family?
Yeah, it's interesting. There are a lot of takeaways, but I'm just about getting ready to go on a plane from the East Coast back home to California, and I will sit in the window seat, and I'll be staring out the window, looking at this vast flyover country that everybody talks about. And I think people should understand, and I hope they do understand, and if they read the book, they will understand, that down below there in all those empty spaces are a lot of people working really, really hard, trying to make a living, trying to hold tight to tradition. These are the kind of people who built the West, warts and all, whatever. But I certainly now look at that kind of Western landscape and think, is it changing, and is it changing for the good? And is there a place for people like this that have helped build the West?
Well, thank you very much, John Branch, author most recently of The Last Cowboys, A Pioneer Family in the New West. And as you've heard, he's getting ready to board a plane there. We appreciate you taking some time to be with us.
My pleasure. Thank you so much.
And thanks for listening to Access Utah. Again, the name of the book is The Last Cowboys, A Pioneer Family in the New West. And we're talking there with Pulitzer Prize-winning writer John Branch. And that episode of Access Utah was a part of the Democracy and the Informed Citizen Initiative, administered by the Federation of State Humanities Councils in partnership with the Pulitzer Prizes Board for a collaboration between UPR, Utah Humanities, the Salt Lake Tribune, and the Salt Lake City Library. The initiative seeks to deepen the public's knowledge and appreciation of vital connections between democracy, the humanities, journalism, and an informed citizenry. The Democracy and the Informed Citizen Initiative is supported by the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. So I hope you enjoyed that conversation with John Branch from May of 2018. Now we turn, as we do on Thursdays, to Leo T. and Skywatcher.
It's one sky, many cultures, skywatching Leo T. in the morning, grabbing a hot cup of joe and a lawn chair and looking to the east in the pre-dawn sky above the mountains. And there is Jupiter and Mars, which rise earlier every day. The brighter one, of course, will be Jupiter. They get closer every morning. After enjoying the summer day going by, a little breeze and some trees and clouds and hopefully some blue sky, 20 minutes or so after sunset, find Venus in the west hanging with Regulus and Leo in the west. And as the night evolves toward midnight or on to 4 a.m., keep an eye out for the Perseid meteor shower coming to life, building to a peak in about August 11th and 12th. In the dark of the moon at this point, it will be a good year to harvest meteorites. So if you're on a kayak or a canoe out on a lake in the mountains or on the desert, see the streaks as they shoot over or in the reflection in the lake. And the full moon showed up for the anniversary of the first human landing on itself. The landing on July 20th, 1969, just a month before Woodstock. The official moon was full on the 21st, but hey, it's casually full on the 20th, just in time. People from all around the world were looking up to celebrate both the wonders of the moon and humanity's first landing. A full moon photograph from the Apollo 11 spacecraft during its journey homeward, thanks to NASA, on the Skywatcher Facebook page. And they're calling it the Buck Full Moon, named as such according to MARCA website, M-A-R-C-A. Buck Moon reflects the time of year when the male deer or bucks grow new antlers. The rapid growth of these antlers in July is a key event in the life cycle of deer, making it a significant time for indigenous tribes who relied on animals for food and materials. The Buck Moon is also known by other names, such as the Thunder Moon, due to the frequent thunderstorms during this month, hopefully. And as the full Buck Moon tipped its hat to space and Earthlings, the event provides an opportunity to reflect on our enduring fascination with our closest neighbor that has gone on since before humanity existed with all sorts of animals, maybe Paramecium. And now, as the moon shines on in the night sky a few nights later, take a moment to revel in its beauty and search for a large, dark plane. The surface feature is the Sea of Tranquility, where the Apollo 11 mission landed. If you were alive then, as I was, as a 9-year-old boy, seeing these images on the television screen, and then, of course, it was on the radio then, it united people all around the world. And then as we went outside the house and the TV, looking up at the moon in the blue dusk, tried to grasp that there were humans on the surface up there. Astronauts Neil Young and Buzz Aldrin were doing the first moonwalk, way before Michael Jackson. And Michael Collins orbiting overhead, stoking the home fires till they came back to rendezvous and went back to Earth. And now scientists have found a subterranean cave beneath the Sea of Tranquility. Lunar caves are underground passages formed when volcanic processes during the moon's early history are connected to pits covering the lunar surface. A little future work for a spelunker astronaut. Where do I apply? Oh, I don't know how to climb in a cave. So thanks for listening. Keep looking up. Do a little space exploration on your own and get lost just a little bit in space. Skywatcher Leo T.